supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A mother and her four children have been living in sanctuary at a North Philadelphia church for the past 7 weeks after their asylum petition was denied and they received a deportation order. Today, the undocumented children left to go to school for the first time since they began living there. For WHYY, Sarah Hoover reports that they got a big send-off.
Dozens of supporters gathered at a rally outside of Church of the Advocate as Carmela Apollonia Hernandez prepared to send her children to their first day of school. Hernandez thanked the crowd, but could only walk to the archway before her ankle monitor started beeping, shocking her leg, warning her to back up. She's worn the ankle bracelet for 2 years since asking for asylum. The 36-year-old mom and her four kids have lived in sanctuary for nearly 2 months, since they found out their asylum request was denied and face immediate deportation. Hernandez says being cooped up that long has been difficult for her kids, who are 15, 13, 11, and 9.
Como ven, ellos son unos niños y a veces se desesperan.
I want you to understand that they are children. And for them to be cooped up in rooms under sanctuary, it's very, very hard not to be able to go out. And sometimes they get a little desperate and think that they really need to be free and be able to just walk out. Today they are walking out, but we want to be free. We want to be permanently free.
The family's case is pending before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Volunteers held signs in English and Spanish. One read, Sanctuary for All, another, Carmela Libre. Speakers stood on the steps of the church under a banner that read, Sanctuary, Not Deportation, including Hillary Leonardopoulos, the legislative representative for Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. She says she admires the family's bravery.
Nobody should have to fight this hard to be recognized as a human being.
As the kids left for school, the crowd sang hymns in English and Spanish.
No!
If they don't manage to prevail in court, they face the choice of deportation or continuing to live in sanctuary. Immigration and Customs Enforcement doesn't have a firm policy on such cases, but tends to avoid deportation actions at sensitive locations such as churches. For WHYY News, Sarah Hoover.
Documents published by State Impact Pennsylvania raise questions about how permits for a controversial pipeline project got approved by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. The documents showed text messages exchanged between a senior staffer in Governor Tom Wolf's office and the state's chief environmental regulator. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips joins us to talk about the story. And Susan, what's in these text messages?
Well, Dave, there's a lot that's not in them, right? Because there are more than 6 pages of blacked out texts here. So we don't know everything about what they say. But they do show a lot of messaging about the controversial Mariner East 2 permits between then acting DEP Secretary Patrick McDonnell and a governor's aide named Yesenia Bain, who happens to be married to a gas industry lobbyist. The texts span several months prior to DEP's decision to approve the permits in February 2017. And during this time, DEP had rejected Sunoco's permits several times, citing deficiencies related to water crossings, earth moving, erosion and sediment control. And, you know, this is one of the largest projects that DEP has ever had to permit. It's a pipeline that runs 350 miles across the state. And in doing so, it's going to cross more than 1,200 streams and wetlands.
What can be gleaned from the available texts?
Wolf's staffer, Yesenia Bain, asked the head of the DEP not to send letters to Sunoco detailing all these problems with water crossing specifically with its permit applications until the governor could be updated. She also asked whether some of these deficiencies cited in the Sunoco's Mariner East 2 plans could, quote, remain flexible for field adjustments. They also show a Sunoco lobbyist communicating directly with the governor's office over the permits rather than him communicating with DEP.
Susan, what are you hearing from the governor's office?
The governor's office says this is normal on a project this large, and it's just a routine exchange of information.
What's the current status of the project?
So actually, some of the issues that were brought up, not just by DEP staffers, but by those folks who were issuing public comments during the permit process, we've seen that come to fruition, Dave. We've seen dozens of waterways polluted. And as we reported on the community in Chester County, which lost its water supply due to a drill puncturing the aquifer up there, that's another example. There was exceptionally valued wetlands that were damaged with drilling mud spills. And so these text messages sort of bolster the environmentalists and the opponents' feeling that somehow the Wolf administration did do undue influence over this permitting process and didn't leave it to the environmental regulators to make sure it was done correctly. And as a result, there was a couple things that happened last summer. There was a consent decree where Sunoco was ordered to, you know, step up its game, basically, and protect water supplies. But what happened later in the fall was that DEP discovered that they were drilling in unpermitted areas that they were not allowed to drill in, and that they've polluted even more water supplies by doing so. So earlier this month, they made the unusual decision to pull the permits, essentially, and say you can't continue construction on anything having to do with the permits we gave you until you comply with, you know, they gave them this long to-do list. So that's where we're at right now.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips on NewsWorks Tonight. Pennsylvania's first state-approved medical marijuana dispensaries are opening as soon as next month. WPSU's Ann Danahy looks at the goals for medical marijuana and what it could mean for patients.
All right, Ryan. Time for your special medicine.
Diana Briggs is giving her son, Ryan, a very small dose of medical marijuana. It's something she does every night, carefully putting a coconut oil in his feeding tube. Ryan suffered from a lack of oxygen at birth that injured his brain. It left him with many challenges, including seizures, some days in the hundreds.
My son had never slept. I can look back at Facebook posts from years ago where I was praying and begging people to pray that Ryan would sleep. He was seizing 72 hours straight with no break.
The Briggses tried more than 10 drugs for Ryan. They tried unconventional treatments too, stem cells and hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
There was that horrible honeymoon phase. The seizures always came back.
A friend told Diana Briggs about medical marijuana after hearing the story of a little girl in Colorado whose parents turned to it to treat her seizures. Briggs started doing research, and then she went to the doctor.
And said, what are your thoughts on marijuana? And I can say she didn't have much to say.
Now the Briggses treat Ryan with a coconut oil that has CBD and THC in it. Those are both compounds found in marijuana. The Briggses live in the Pittsburgh area, and the treatment Ryan was getting was illegal. Now Diana Briggs has what's known as a safe harbor letter. With that, she can order medical marijuana for her 17-year-old son. Soon, she'll be able to walk into a dispensary and buy it. Families like the Briggses are the reason Republican State Senator Mike Fulmer was behind legislation to make medical marijuana legal in Pennsylvania.
The goal here was to give Pennsylvanians an opportunity to have one more arrow in their quiver to fight any battle, and of course, their medical professional to fight any medical battles that they may be faced with.
Fulmer himself used marijuana when he was being treated for cancer. He says medical marijuana isn't a cure-all, but he thinks any negative side effects are overplayed.
This is real medicine. This works.
He says it comes down to letting people choose what's best for them.
No government should stand between a person and their medical professional and their health. It's between me, God, my doctor.
Governor Wolf signed the medical marijuana law in April 2016. Since then, the Department of Health has been working to get growers and sellers approved and operational. To buy medical marijuana legally, Pennsylvanians need to get a doctor to certify they have one of 17 conditions. Those include cancer, Parkinson's disease, and chronic pain. Scott Camazine is a doctor who has worked in emergency care for more than 30 years. Now he's focused on treating patients who are addicts.
There are now numerous studies that suggest that medical marijuana has a place in reducing patients' need for pain medication and for helping them not get in a situation where they're overdosing on opiates.
Camazine works at a clinic in Lock Haven. He's one of the doctors in Pennsylvania approved to certify patients for the medical marijuana program. He doesn't think it's going to solve the opiate problem, but it could help.
Nobody dies of an overdose of marijuana.
He thinks it could also help with conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder. The first batch of medical marijuana from a Pennsylvania grower could become available in February. Not everyone is sure this is good news. Jake Peters is a faculty member in pharmacy practice at Butler University in Indiana. Peters focuses on mental health and behavioral care and sees patients who self-medicate or use drugs illegally. He looks at the effects of marijuana on psychiatric disorders like depression, psychosis, and substance use disorders. He says marijuana might make patients feel better in the interim, but it can make disorders like depression and anxiety worse in the long run.
I would like to see, prior to using it from a medical standpoint, more definitive research of like, okay, when it does become legal, where does it actually fit in therapy? We have a better idea. And right now we're still, in some instances, throwing darts at a dartboard.
Diana Briggs' son, Ryan, still has seizures, but far fewer and less severe.
Now, Ryan sleeps 8 to 10 hours a night. If he does have a seizure, they're so small that they do not wake him.
Briggs helped start Campaign for Compassion and is now executive director of the organization. She and other mothers and family members drove countless times to Harrisburg to meet with legislators about making medical marijuana legal.
Being able to go and get our medicine safely here in our state is going to be a dream come true.
Patients who want to buy medical marijuana need to get certification from a doctor and an ID card through the State Department of Health. The first dispensary is expected to begin sales in February. In State College, I'm Ann Danahy.
For a follow-up story on marijuana in Pennsylvania, listen to WHYY's Morning Edition tomorrow. Many small arts organizations across Philadelphia that would otherwise go wanting are able to stay solvent and grow thanks to grants from the city's Philadelphia Cultural Fund. Let's look at the scope of the program and its recipients with Barbara Silsley, Executive Director of Philadelphia Cultural Fund. Barbara, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The fund has been in existence since 1991. What is its mission?
Its mission is, in a broad way, to support arts and culture in Philadelphia and to make Philadelphia a more vibrant place. We are not having our peer panelists assess the quality of the art so much as the viability of the organization and its ability to carry out its programming, and most especially, its community impact.
Philadelphia is famously and proudly comprised of its communities. How do you assess which communities get this funding, and is it in part intended to be distributed across all neighborhoods and communities in the city?
It's a much bigger story than just where's their address. For our qualifying, they have to be a Philadelphia-based organization doing the bulk of their work in Philadelphia for Philadelphia. But if we're looking at impact, where are they doing their work? So it was pretty thrilling to see. We had 302 grantees last year, but there were over 3,100 what we're calling programming locations throughout the city. So that it's a much bigger impact than just simply where their address is.
So those some 300 organizations divvied up some $3 million last year.
Yes.
How do you measure success in terms of their ability to sustain and grow based on, in large measure, these grants?
The critical thing for us is sustaining. The fact that so few are disappearing is a positive sign, but we're nervous. Frankly, the cultural fund and the sector is nervous about the climate, the current climate, and the cuts that are happening across the board and lack of support and the trickle down of funding, not so much from the city because we have been so fortunate. We have a very supportive mayor and city council.
Well, then where does that fear come from?
The fear is coming more from individuals and foundations and corporations that maybe are investing in other ways now. I think part of it is what I've heard is that some organizations have lost considerable grants from individuals as those individuals are trying to address very real social perceived problems that are trickling down. Certainly, a lot of us are concerned about the threat to, let's say, Planned Parenthood or the environment. So if those things are close to your heart, you feel there's a state of emergency to support those, you could be diverting your individual giving to those, understandably. And that is critical. Those are critical organizations and institutions and programs to support and fund. But where I'm sitting is looking at the arts and culture, it's also critical. Over 50% of our grantees are working with Philadelphia school kids inside and outside of schools, for instance. That's critical programming. The arts are not the emergency to fund. Arts are often the solution to emergencies.
You touched on schools. Expand on that, if you will. The long-term cash-strapped Philadelphia School District often first makes cuts to its arts and culture programs.
Children who participate in arts, over time, absolutely their SAT scores go up. Also, the dropout rate goes down. It's not unlike sports. Kids learn they have to show up. They depend on each other. So while they might play in a band or sing in a group or are going to be in a play, they have to show up to that rehearsal. Their peers depend on them. Their community depends on them. And they learn the value of themselves and that they must show up. And it lights something. So while that child may never be an actor or a singer, et cetera, what they're going to learn is so many important societal skills that are also valuable now in the workplace. And I think that that's what the arts can bring.
Barbara Silsley, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure.
Barbara Silsley is Executive Director of Philadelphia Cultural Fund.
Can't wait for the Super Bowl? Wednesday night affords sky gazers a chance to take in a super lunar eclipse. Joining me with the play-by-play is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Though, Derek, odds makers say the Eagles have a much better chance of prevailing than Philadelphia area residents have of spying this supermoon.
I would always say that would be the case for the Philadelphia Eagles in this particular instance of the astronomical things that are happening around the same time. As it turns out, there is this sort of Super Bowl of astronomical events in a way. However, I have to preface this by saying I really don't believe in overhyping certain kinds of things just to draw attention. And that's something that's happened with this concept of the super moon. Yeah, I'm sort of not on the bandwagon with that one. So tomorrow evening, as you're watching the just before full moon rise, you'll notice that the moon looks rather large near objects of known size. That physical positioning, as we see it, allows the moon to look very, very big. Now, the exercise that I'll ask our listeners to perform is measure the size of the moon on the horizon. And then 6 hours later, when the moon is high overhead, measure it again using the same measuring tool and see if the two measurements come anywhere near each other. In fact, they should actually turn out to be exactly the same.
So what of this so-called Wednesday blue blood total lunar eclipse?
It's really the confluence of three things that are occurring right around this time. This full moon will be the second full moon of the month, the first one having occurred on January 1st. So that takes care of the super part. Now, the blue part, as we said, was because it's the second full moon. Now, the blood part actually is the fact that there happens to be a total lunar eclipse happening on Wednesday also. But the difficulty is that we here on the East Coast won't get to see very much of that lunar eclipse at all. Most of what we'll be able to see is the full moon itself. We'll also be able to, of course, go along with the fact that it's a blue moon because it's the second full moon. We can sort of experience the super part of it because it's a close approach perigee, but the lunar eclipse part itself, out on the West Coast, we'd be able to see almost all of the eclipse.
Okay, next distraction pre-Super Bowl, Friday's Groundhog Day.
Yes, indeed it is. And I'm trying to remember if the calling here is that if the groundhog sees his shadow, then the Eagles win? Or is it the other way around?
Both ways.
I think it's – oh, yes, that's right. It's both ways. Yeah. You're right.
It extends to teams with animal logos, so the Patriots can't possibly win.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. So Eagles and groundhogs, they get along well together.
Kindred.
Exactly. They're sharing good luck. Okay. February 2nd is the first cross-quarter day of the year. It's that point that's halfway between the winter solstice of the year before and the vernal equinox of this year coming. So the legend goes, of course, that if the groundhog sees his shadow on that day, that means there's six more weeks of winter. If he doesn't see a shadow on that day, that would mean that winter would be ending sooner. The truth of the matter is, it's the motion of the earth around the sun that really makes the difference, and I'm not very sure that even if all the groundhogs got together, they'd have much of an effect on that. So no matter what happens on Friday, we'll still have those 6 weeks of winter left before we get there.
Good thing our listening range doesn't extend to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania.
They'd have another idea altogether. It's surprising the degree to which that cross-quarter day is celebrated by so many people so early in the morning for a groundhog to tell us what might be coming.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.